It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem, Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Hi, Top Green Tree Hill. We welcome you to the Monday edition of The Ride Home, this gorgeous day, the 15th of April. Kath?
It's incredible. Lovely. Even though it's Monday, I mean, I opened my eyes this morning. The sun was pouring in the window.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, bring it.
The birds are chirping.
Bring
right?
it.
It's very nice.
I felt
lovely.
Really good about it.
This is springtime, finally.
Yeah, and then, but like the high on Saturday is like 61.
It's okay.
The
That's
high.
In the future.
Okay.
61. Come on.
I know, but it's still like, right. Now it seems like it should be 71.
It's perfect. I keep on thinking about Doug Oster was with us on Friday. He said, you know, this week, everything's going to get heated up and then it'll blossom.
Right. Everything's going to
Everything
start.
Already has.
You should see what things are growing in my yard.
Mm.
I can't believe it.
I love it.
My herbs are enormous.
Really?
Yeah. It's just really exciting.
Have you cut the grass yet?
Well, I've never cut the grass.
Right.
My whole life.
Has your husband cut the grass?
Oh, yeah. Three
has
times.
He? Three times?
Mm-hmm.
Three times?
Yeah.
Look, he's going to get an award.
Listen,
like
this, this is who he is. You
Holy
know this.
Holy smokes.
You know this. You know this. We had a bridal shower for my daughter.
Oh, of course. So,
on
right,
Saturday. No. Listen. The shower started at noon.
Yeah.
And people were there until 5:30. We were just having a good time. Right.
We in the yard?
As soon as maybe 3:30 hit, you know, because we were just hanging out at that point. My husband comes in. It was a guy shower too. So he was around.
Yeah.
He said, you okay if I take off? I was like, sure. He said, I need to go out and do the yard.
He cut the grass so while the shower was going
exactly.
on. Man, he's committed.
Mm-hmm. And so the other guys that were at the shower,
they were out there helping.
They went out and chatted with him. Just help, you know.
Guys and lawnmowers.
That's just what it is.
Very nice.
That's
mm-hmm.
just what it is.
Excellent.
Coming up on today's show in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to continue our immersion. Well, maybe not immersion, but our sampling of National Poetry Month.
We are, yeah.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to that. Also, our good friend Ann Kennedy, how to make it easier for your kid to be a Christian.
I like this.
Now, this isn't how you can make your kid into a Christian, because that's never going to happen.
No.
If you look at it that way, it's never going to happen. But how can you make it easier? We'll talk about that. Also, the mental health benefits of going to church, not just watching it online or not just listening to, you know, Tim Keller preach, which is terrific, but the mental health benefits of actually getting up and going.
Showing up.
We'll talk about that. And then in the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court a little bit with our good friend Bruce Ankoviak, who's a law professor at St. Vincent College. Also, top destinations for summer vacations 2024 as compiled by our good friends at Google.
Mm-hmm.
And in just a couple minutes, we'll go to the White House.
Are they your good friends?
I don't think they are, really. They look so friendly in the
do.
Little thing.
Right.
I think they
It
could,
does feel a little nefarious at times.
I think they could be, you know, the dark side of the world.
Okay, a big news day. There's a lot happening. So without further ado, Kath, please, as you are wont to do, give us the top four at four.
For Monday, April 15th, John, 2024, number one. Saturday's strike from Iran on Israel included more than 170 explosive-laden drones, about 120 ballistic missiles, and about 30 cruise missiles. As it turned out, though, almost all were intercepted due to a combination of Israel's sophisticated air defense and also critical assistance provided by the U.S. and other Arab partners and Western partners.
Good.
American, British, and Jordanian warplanes played an especially important role in downing drones. Most of the Iranian drones and missiles were destroyed before they even got to Israeli airspace. Iran's first direct military attack on Israel since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Apparently, John has used up only a tiny bit of Iran's vast arsenal of drones and missiles. And according to today's Wall Street Journal, they have an excellent piece The Iranian military has drawn valuable intelligence from observing how the U.S. and all their allies responded.
Sure.
Right. Countries closed their airspace temporarily due to the attack. They have reopened and air traffic has resumed. Now, the article goes into some of the Arab allies and that type of alliance that the U.S. has been crafting for the last several months. Apparently, based on their involvement in what happened over the weekend, no matter how much those people who work in those countries in governmental places may dislike Benjamin Netanyahu, they dislike Iran's government even more. So read more details at today's Wall Street Journal. Number two, the first criminal trial of a former president in U.S. history got underway today in a crowded Manhattan courtroom, both sides prepping for the arduous task, can you imagine, of trying to find 12 people to serve on this jury.
In Manhattan.
The people of the state of New York versus Donald Trump. Flanked by his attorneys in room 1513 of Manhattan Criminal Court, Trump sat at a table where countless defendants before him have appeared. The presumptive Republican nominee for president addressed reporters beforehand and said, quote, this really is an attack on a political opponent. That's all it is, so I'm very honored to be here. He's charged with 34 state counts of falsifying business records related to a hush money payment his attorney made to adult film star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Read more about that at CBS News. Number three, a headline, John, a headline in the April 3rd edition of the New York Post read, this surprising city was named top global destination by travel expert. That surprising city is Pittsburgh, and it's included in the new National Geographic book as among the top 100 unexpected destinations in the world by travel writer Andrew Nelson.
Really?
You want to know what he said about Pittsburgh?
Please, yes.
He said it's a revelation. Like San Francisco, it's a mix of forward-thinking tech sectors mixed with some of the most historic and community-minded 19th century neighborhoods found anywhere. And of course, all the hills. Pittsburgh was included among several global destinations, including Paris, Borobudur, Indonesia, Lecce, Italy, Montevideo, Uruguay, and Western Cape, South Africa.
Fabulous.
How about that?
We're making everybody in Verona and Cheswick.
Yes.
Right? Lower Borough, proud.
And Upper Borough.
Yeah,
don't forget them. Read more about that at Pittsburgh Magazine. And number four, yesterday, the Bucks were looking for a series split in the fourth and final game against the Phillies at Citizens Bank Park. Jack Sawinski, who has been on the schneid, got off the schneid. Sixth inning, grand slam, and of course, the 300th home run for Andrew McCutchen. And that's your top four at
Excellent.
Four.
And the great story of the dad and his son who got the 300th ball.
Oh, my gosh. How about that? Was that kid the best?
The dad's fabulous. I mean, totally.
And how about Kutch coming out when they met and
hey,
saying, hey, giving him a hug.
Yeah.
I can't believe a Pirate fan caught the ball.
So cool.
In Philadelphia.
Excellent.
Wasn't that great? Also, Keller looked really good yesterday.
He sure did. Yeah.
Again. Boy, I was so happy to see Sawinski hit that ball.
Mm-hmm. Bucks are looking good.
Man. And, you know, Kutch said this, but a lot of people said it about him. I think it was Keller. I have this quote. He said, I'm just going to be happy for Kutch. I know it's been a long time coming since last year. Finally, just to be able to do it, it's a weight off his shoulders. We all couldn't be more thrilled.
Oh, man. Kutch's name etched with some of the greats in baseball. No doubt about that. We'll take a quick break. Come back. When we do come back, we go to the White House, as we are wont to do every Monday. Greg Clarkson joins us next on The Ride Home, where Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's Word FM. SR News White House correspondent Greg Clugston joins us now to bring us up to date about what's going on in the nation's capital, our country, and around the world. Hey, Greg, happy Monday to you.
Well, good afternoon, John. Kathy, great to be with you as always.
Greg, let's start with the goings-on in Israel. A huge attack by Iran over the weekend. Most of the missiles that were launched, however, didn't even make it into Israeli airspace. Tell us about it.
Right. You had more than 300 ballistic missiles and cruise missiles sent from Iran headed toward Israel. And, you know, you have what the Israeli military saying something like 99% of those missiles were intercepted. So you had the United States and some other allies working cooperatively with Israel in defense of this this attack. And this is really this is an attack we've never seen before. We've never seen Iran attack the land of Israel under its current, you know, jurisdiction like this. So it's unprecedented in that nature. And they clearly, Iran clearly was not just sending a message. They were there was an intent to do harm. That's very clear when talking to U.S. military officials, as well as senior administration officials who have been briefing reporters over the last 48 hours. And they and they from a military perspective say that this was, and they use this word very carefully, spectacular success from a military perspective of the percentage of, you know, intercepts that they were able to get here, because even one or two of these missiles, had they hit in a populated area, could have been deadly and done a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, it's really amazing. This feels as though it's a whole new way for war, right? I mean, these drone attacks, from now on forward, we're going to see this whenever, you know, whether it's first wave or last wave, hundreds and hundreds of drones at one time, Greg.
You know, and the other interesting thing, too, John, and you're right in saying that, and this goes to that point of a new type of war, and it's a new type of way that the U.S., I'm sorry, not just the U.S., that the world is watching these events happen in real time, because by the time it was announced that these missiles and drones were on their way, It was a few hours before the full time elapsed of that potential confrontation there, and so, you know, people were essentially saying, we've got these projectiles in the air on the way to Israel, and we're waiting to see what the result was going to be. So it was as if, even though we didn't have the live feed of what military officials would and what the Situation Room at the White House would have, we certainly were being kept abreast in a very real-time manner, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect. Of course, no one did. But I got to admit, I was surprised at the effectiveness of 99% of the drones. I mean, a poor little 7-year-old girl apparently was the only injury and all that. This was good news for everybody, except for the little girl, of course.
Well, sure, it is. And obviously, you know, this all begs the question of what happens next, what happens now. And of course, you've got the United States through the Biden administration, President Biden, you know, really cautioning both publicly and also in private phone calls with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, really urging there to be kind of a step back here and real, you know, cautious assessment of the best plan forward. You had the war cabinet in Israel meeting here within the last 24 hours, and they're trying to figure out what to do. You've got any number of people in Israel who say that this is an aggression that can't, you know, that cannot go unanswered. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, if it does not go unanswered, at what level would the response be, and how would that look? Of course, what the concern of the United States and a lot of allies and a lot of countries in that region centers on is whether this is going to spiral into some sort of larger regional conflict than it already has become, and that's a real concern, obviously.
Mm, yeah, but isn't it an interesting story how the alliances have formed? Talk about the U.S. involvement in recruiting Britain to be part, but also Jordan to be part of a force that was shooting down missiles.
Sure. You know, what's interesting, Kathy, is that because of what we were already dealing with in terms of the Gaza war in Israel, because of what happened back on October 7th and that Hamas attack into Israeli territory and the ensuing months now, the 6+ months, already there was this international coalition, in a sense, that was being put together and that had really formed in terms of support for Israel against what was this Hamas-led terrorist attack and the Gaza war. And even though, obviously, there are differences about exactly perceptions of ideas of how the United States, how the Israeli Defense Military Forces have gone after targets inside Gaza and the question about humanitarian aid and civilian casualties and all the rest, there still was this overwhelming international coalition of support for Israel that had already been started there. And so when there was this concern about, you know, Iran here in the last few weeks, you already had that foundation in place. And Biden administration officials over the weekend were saying that was very instrumental in having almost instant support for Israel when it came to this kind of coordination.
Mm-hmm. SRN News correspondent Greg Clugson is with us from the White House. Greg, a sad day. This is the first time in the history of our great country that a former president has sat in a courtroom and is facing criminal charges. Talk about what happened today.
Well, this was the first official day of this trial in New York, the first criminal prosecution of Donald Trump. He is facing, currently four, potential trials. And this is the first one in New York City in the Manhattan courtroom where he was there today. And this morning, there was a lot of back and forth between lawyers from both sides and discussions with the judge. And so the jury selection did not get officially underway this morning. The plan was for that, to happen as the day went on and in the coming days. And so what's interesting here is that I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the 42 question juror questionnaire.
No.
And a lot of the questions, they're common types of questions that appear on these types of questionnaires for potential jurors in any number of cases. But there are some that are very specific to this case. Interestingly, for example, have you, a relative or a close friend, ever worked for any company or organization owned or run by Donald Trump? Mm. Have you, a relative, a close friend, ever worked or volunteered for the campaign of Donald Trump? Or attended a political rally or signed up for an email list? There are questions about where potential jurors receive their news. What media sources do they have? Online, newspaper, television, radio, that kind of thing. And then other questions, do you have strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about whether a former president may be criminally charged in state court?
Really?
And then this, do you have any feelings or opinions about how Mr. Trump is being treated in this case?
Oh.
So some are very specific. And when it goes to, do you have any feelings or opinions or strong feelings or opinions, that really kind of crystallizes the hard work ahead in selecting a jury.
How are you going to find 12 people who don't have a strong feeling about Donald Trump?
Well, see, that's just the case. And not only just 12, but also six alternates.
Right.
Yeah. So you're looking at 18.
Oh, my gosh.
Here's the one way to think about that, Kathy, as daunting as that sounds and perhaps is. Obviously, people don't stop having opinions or beliefs because they've been selected to a jury. The question is whether or not they can set aside mm-hmm. those opinions and beliefs and in a very fair and balanced way evaluate the evidence that is presented them. And so, these questions are an attempt to get at finding those kind of people in those categories.
Oh, right? My gosh. I cannot imagine.
Well, you have to have hope for humanity that there are people out
there
who can do this, right?
Exactly.
Fairly, right?
Exactly.
Set these aside.
All right, let's talk about the 2024 election that's coming up. Of course, we've got one of the candidates who's right now sitting in a criminal trial, as we said. What are we hearing about election polls? Are they showing us any sort of, tendencies or trends?
Yeah, I know. A few weeks ago, we were looking at some polls. I think it was the New York Times, Siena College polls. They were looking at some of the key battleground states. And some other news organizations have also done some recent surveys. And it looks as if some of the margin and a month ago, you did see Trump winning, I think, in like six out of seven battleground states, leading Joe Biden, in some cases by just a very few percentage points. So it's obviously going to be a very close race, as indicated by the survey numbers. But those numbers have tightened up over the last month a little bit, by maybe two or three percentage points here and there. And so all of that means, Kathy, is that we are still looking at probably, six or seven very key battleground or swing states in this country, including Pennsylvania is in that mix, and along with North Carolina, and then Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada. Did I say Georgia, North Carolina? Yeah, those are the seven that so many people are really looking at. And speaking of Pennsylvania, Joe Biden is going to be in Pennsylvania 3 days this week.
What? Really?
Including in Pittsburgh on Thursday. He's going to be giving some remarks to, I think, a steel workers union there as well. But he's going to be in Scranton tomorrow, and he's going to be in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh this week. And so it's just another indication of, for example, Pennsylvania being a very key case. I was in Wisconsin last week doing some advance work before the Republican National Convention, which will be in Milwaukee in the middle of July. And Wisconsin is one of those, you know, potential blue wall states for Joe Biden. But, of course, Donald Trump is, you know, he won that state along with Michigan in 2016. And so these are very tight races, and it's very interesting to see what happens. And then, of course, one thing that we didn't have as much 4 years ago that is going to be more of a factor in certain states on certain ballots in 2024, the number of independent and third party candidates like RFK Jr. Continues to get access to various state ballots. I think Iowa was the latest one over the weekend, and he's working on some other key states, and he's not the only third party candidate out there, although he's probably the most high profile right now. And so Joe Biden really didn't have as much of a potential, you know, draw off from these third party candidates 4 years ago. We'll have to see what happens and exactly who these candidates draw from, whether it's from Trump or Biden or a little of both.
Mm-hmm. Greg, before you leave us, you know, of course, we have to take a little trip down the garden path.
This
one's kind of serious, though. It's a little bit personal. We're talking right after the 5 o'clock news break about the mental health benefits that are linked to actually going to church. This is an article in today's Wall Street Journal. And so we talk a lot about how people consume church. You know, they watch online or they listen to sermons during the week or whatever. But attendance is, you know, vastly different than it was before COVID. So talk about you and your family, but you in particular, because you're the one that we know. Do you go to church, and do you sense a benefit to your own personality, to your own outlook? What's that like for you?
Yeah, well, I do attend church on a weekly basis, and I'm involved in a variety of ministries and areas of our local church, and we have been at our same church for over 30 years. Here in Maryland, in the greater D.C. area. And so I'm in the building, you know, more times than just on a Sunday morning. But in terms of like a worship service and on a Sunday morning, for example, a regular attender. And sure, like a lot of people, there was a time after the pandemic as we were starting to come out of the pandemic, you know, we did not attend in person, but then we slowly started to gather back again. And while there was that connection by watching services online, at least at first, and of course, you know, the pandemic at the very beginning, everything was so new. There were so many questions. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of fears. And so I think people still felt a connection just because they were doing something at the same time collectively.
Yeah.
But as time has gone on, and kind of the newness of live streaming for some churches or meeting by Zoom or watching on Facebook and all that kind of thing, I think that's worn off a little bit. And I think it can become a little sterile and stale sometimes when you're simply relying on a live feed as opposed to interacting with people and being there in person.
Yep. You need community face to face.
Listen,
right?
It changes my mental health.
To show up. Yeah, without a doubt.
And even, you know, I woke up yesterday morning, I wanted to stay asleep.
Right.
I did. But going, I'm never, ever sorry I went.
No, you go in one way and come out another.
Yep,
right?
That's how I feel.
Totally different.
Yeah.
The other thing to think about is not just about yourself, but that your presence there may be an encouragement or help to somebody else who needs
excellent.
That
yeah.
as well.
Very yeah, good. That's so true. Greg, thanks for joining us, as always.
You bet. My pleasure, guys.
Have a terrific week.
Very good.
Thanks.
Greg Clugston, SRN News White House correspondent. Information about SRN News, wordfm.com. Be right back. We'll take a little quick look at vacation hotspots for the year.
Okay, I want to think about my vacation.
Nice. Vacation plans, right? Here it is, mid-April.
I don't have any.
Not yet.
Mm-mm.
I do.
Okay.
I'm making plans.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I've yet to put my time in request.
Oh, well, then you don't really have plans.
Well, I've got plans. I just haven't done the paperwork yet. That's all.
I mean, asking the powers that be is kind of an important element.
Right. It's going to happen. I feel good about it. Anyway, Google, as they are wont to do, has compiled their top locations where people are headed. Yeah.
Okay.
This is weird. Google gathers insights from mid-January through mid-March.
Okay.
They look for queries top of mind of searches for travel itinerary, and solo travel reached an all-time high in January.
Okay.
The top trending weekend getaways. Weekend getaways? Palm Springs and Florida Keys.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So these are the top 20 locations that came up from Google searches.
Okay, are you starting at 20?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, I'll run them down. San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Okay.
Boston.
Okay.
Madrid.
Madrid. Mm-hmm. Nice. Now, this is not for a weekend getaway. This is for a longer vacation.
Yeah, money's on the table.
Okay, Madrid. Where are we going? Yeah. Nice, okay.
Denver.
Okay.
Honolulu.
Yeah.
Fort Lauderdale. Dublin.
Mm.
Barcelona.
Okay.
Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I love California.
But not
I
to
would
go there.
Never go to L.A. for vacation. Are you kidding me? Mm. Go ahead.
Here we are breaking through the 10. This is number 10. Athens.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Las Vegas.
That's tragic.
My brother was just in Las Vegas with his grandson and wife last week. Not good.
For vacation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean not good?
Not family friendly. He said his kid was accosted on the strip. He said it was really, kind of a dirty, ugly experience.
Yeah, which shouldn't really be a surprise,
no,
isn't it? Vegas,
right. Okay, number 10, Athens. Number 9, Seattle. Then Las Vegas. Then Orlando.
Mm.
Number 6, Cancun. Number 5, New York City. Number 4, Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Number 3, Tokyo.
Really?
Go to Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. That shocks me.
Number 2, Paris.
Yes, of course. That's the Olympics. Of course.
And the number 1 destination for your summer lineup, London. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to any. I'm going to the beach. Who's right. going to Tokyo for your summer vacation? I don't think so.
That doesn't sound. No.
Orlando?
That doesn't, no.
Imagine going to Orlando. It's 140 degrees.
Exactly.
And you're wearing a little ear hat.
Right.
I don't think so.
Right.
No. Nope. Be fun to go to Athens, but that's a heck of a trip. Barcelona, love to. Denver, Dublin, of course. San Juan.
Paris.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, sure.
If I was going to a city in Spain.
Let's go to the beach.
I'd like to go to Seville more than I'd like to go to Barcelona or Madrid.
Sure. Fine.
I think Seville looks really beautiful.
Ride the trains.
Yeah.
In Europe.
I have this propensity. My family thinks I'm ridiculous, and I don't really care what they think. On YouTube, I like to watch European travel videos.
Yeah.
Like,
here we go.
Anyway, last night what I watched is the top 20 underrated cities in Europe to visit.
That's excellent.
I liked it so much.
Yeah, I'm sure. All these little hidden gems.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for.
Of course.
I mean, I'd go anywhere.
Let's go to Paris.
But if
right?
I was ranking where I would go, I don't need to go to London.
No.
I don't need to go to Madrid. But I would like to go to little places, right?
Off the beaten path.
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Less crowds, your dollar goes a lot further.
Doesn't that seem like a great idea?
I think so as well.
What about the ride home in Europe?
Oh, please. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Lex, let's go. Pack your bags. Here we go. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Come back from St. Vincent College. Law professor Bruce Hankowiak will join us. The Supreme Court and guns. That's straight ahead on the ride home. It used to be in polite company, you would choose not to mention politics and sex. I think you would add guns to that.
Mm-hmm, for
right?
sure.
Politics, religion, sex, and guns. I mean, those are all buzzkills, right? As far as like, hey, let's all get together and talk and have a little party and hang out and have a drink or something, right? Bruce Hankowiak is with us. He is not a buzzkill. Bruce is a law professor at St. Vincent College, here to talk to us about rulings on the Second Amendment and how they can radically change gun laws. Bruce, welcome back.
Thank you very much. And let me tell you, out here in Westmoreland County, guns are a very common topic of gatherings.
Yeah.
Are they?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes.
Okay, so that brings up, you said Westmoreland County. John and I live in Allegheny County. But our eyes are constantly every single day on the news, which is created, of course, from the polls of the country, L.A., Chicago, New York. And guns are so incredibly divisive as a topic of conversation. And a lot of it depends on geographically where you live, yes?
Oh, without a doubt. The common ownership of guns out in places like Westmoreland County, truly anywhere significantly east of Allegheny County, is so much different. And the attitude that people have is so very, very different about it. It's much more just an accepted part of life.
Sure.
Although, again, the constant reports of mass shootings and everything completely and takes everyone to a different level of concern about these matters.
Mm-hmm. So, Bruce, the Supreme Court has been weighing in on a couple of different cases recently. Talk to us about this, please.
Oh, they certainly have, and they have done something in this area that is really unprecedented. In 2022, the Supreme Court decided a case arising out of New York called New York State Rifle Association versus Bruin, and it extended some cases they had previously been ruling on the Second Amendment for decades, for a century or more. The Second Amendment had not even been talked about in the Supreme Court with any degree of regularity. In 2008, the matter suddenly came up very significantly in a case out of the District of Columbia, where the District of Columbia had probably the most restrictive gun law you could imagine. It was almost impossible to get a permit to possess a gun in your home. Mm. And if you did, you had to keep it either disassembled or in a trigger lock.
What?
So that if someone broke in, you would have to politely ask them to wait a few minutes while you prepare to defend yourself.
What the heck?
So a gentleman who was a security guard and who had a gun at work said, you know, I'd like to have one at my house. The Second Amendment was thrown back into his face. The Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, the argument made by the District of Columbia was, this has everything to do with a militia. And if you, sir, are not part of a militia, there is no right that assigns to you whatsoever because of this. Well, the Supreme Court most heartily disagreed with that. They said, look, there are two clauses to this amendment. First one talks about a militia, but that does not limit the second part. The second part creates an individual, personal right to bear arms. The court said, you know, first of all, it says the right of the people. That phrase is used in other parts of the Constitution to mean everybody. And then what I thought was almost a comic position to take, but they said militia at the time this amendment was written meant men of a certain age. And if the only people who would have a right to bear arms were men of a certain age, you would never have used the phrase right of the people.
Right.
That would be way too broad. So they said the right of the people, or more particularly the right of the individual, is predicated primarily on the right of self-defense. And any arms that you would have normally for the purpose of self-defense should be things you don't have to justify possessing. And they cited to things like the state constitutions. Pennsylvania's state constitution reads the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned. Much more direct on that particular point. And so in that first case in 2008, the court said, well, you know, there can certainly be certain reasonable limits, but, you know, you certainly can't have a machine gun or something like that. But a handgun is certainly not an unusual item. It's the classic one for self-defense. So they struck down the Washington, D.C. provision. So now comes the New York law in 2022. This law said you could get a permit to carry if you could establish some proper cause, a special need to have a permit. Mm. Oh, no, the U.S. Supreme Court said. The Second Amendment says you don't have to have a special need. The Second Amendment tells you you have a need to defend yourself. Mm. And while, yes, we could restrict firearms in places, restrictive places like courthouses or schools, they said, gee, the island of Manhattan is not a restricted place. And so, no, you don't have to justify getting a permit like the New York law required. But then it gets a little crazy, because then the Supreme Court says, well, I suppose we should give some guidance as to how other gun laws should be assessed. And they said, well, look at the current gun law, the modern gun law, and ask if it addresses a problem, a societal problem that existed in the 18th century. If it did, then see if it was dealt with back then by some restrictive gun law. And you have to be able to prove that your current law is analogous to a law that was passed back in the 18th century.
Wow.
Wow. Indeed, wow. Because now, besides, you know, having a good lawyer on your staff, you need a historian. You need someone to help you go back and look at what this was.
Now, Bruce, the Supreme Court said that?
Oh, yes, ma'am. No, they didn't say about historian. I added that.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have friends on the history faculty here who need the extra work. you know, and I'm only going to take a 10% referral fee because I'm a reasonable man. But, you know, you look back at the history of the gun laws in this country. How about the English Bill of Rights in 1689? Protestants may have arms for their defense suitable to their conditions and allowed by law. Firearms regulations down through time have reflected the bigotry of the era. For periods of time in this country, Catholics were not allowed to have guns. Slaves certainly were not allowed to have guns. Native Americans, the Irish immigrants who came over, actually barred from having guns. And this was across the country. It just wasn't in southern states, but by any means. And besides restricting guns in places like courthouses, most of the gun restrictions were really on the basis of a class warfare concept. So now the Supreme Court announces this new rule that you have to look for an analogy. What has happened has been nothing short of crazy. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court now where a man violated a federal law because he had a Protection from Abuse Act order against him. Federal law for many years has said if you have such an order against you, you may not possess a firearm. This individual had such an order and was involved in five shootings. He has had the Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit rule that statute unconstitutional, because back in 1790, whatever, there were no laws against people with having a PFA, probably because
there were no PFAs.
Right. Right, exactly. Then there's a case out of a district court in Illinois where, and this was the one that really has sent the shockwaves, a person held a convicted felon in possession of a firearm. And the question is, can you still prohibit convicted felons from possessing firearms? The court in that case said, well, what's the analogy? The government incredibly cited all of the prior restrictions, like you can't have Catholics or African Americans or Native
Americans.
Really? They actually cited this.
Really?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I would.
Like
I
the
would
convicted felon is like a persecuted minority group.
I know. And I just thought to myself, I mean, who in their right mind would have argued this? They did. And the court just dismissed this out of hand. But the one point they made was they said, well, back then, particularly immediately after the Revolution, if you were still a British loyalist and you refuse to pledge allegiance to the United States, then you could be barred. Now, that's different because you make that choice, okay? Right. So the court said, fine. But does that mean all convicted felons have to be barred? And in that case, they said, the man's felonies were a couple of drug sales and a robbery that he accomplished without the use of a firearm. And they said, you have to look specifically at the kind of felony. And they dismissed that criminal complaint.
Wow.
Now, if that holds up, look out. Defense attorneys all over the place should be gearing up for these cases, because normally one of the easiest slam dunk prosecutions you could have is the guy's a convicted felon. He's in possession of a firearm. End of story. Not anymore. The story has other chapters to be written now.
From St. Vincent College, we're talking with lawyer and law attorney Bruce Hankowiak. Bruce, with just a minute or so left, if the Supreme Court can't make sense of gun laws, then what hope is there for lower courts?
None. This is going to be an absolute mess until some other cases come down, or until the majority of the Supreme Court changes over and they get back to a different formulation of how the Second Amendment is supposed to work.
Wow. That's Bruce Hankowiak. Bruce, we really look forward to your time with us.
Thank you.
We're grateful.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Bruce is law professor at St. Vincent College.
Because our firstborn came into this world and immediately went to the NICU, I've got an affinity for the NICU, right? I mean, this was his home, like a lot of babies, for the first few months of his life. Anyway, there's a story in the Washington Post over the weekend about nurses Taylor and Drew Dearis. And there they are, right outside of Methodist Hospital in Washington, D.C. Now, when they met, Taylor and Drew, they were both single, but they were both nurses working at the NICU at Methodist Hospital, Methodist Women's Hospital. And, of course, you know, I can't imagine the number of babies that go through NICUs. Some babies, you know, less than a pound and just barely surviving. Anyway, this story talks about a little baby that came in, a baby named Ella, who was born to a young unwed mother, and she was in her early 20s. And the baby was born at 20 weeks and weighed less than a pound.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. She was.
That would be so scary.
Well, they said, of course, working in the NICU, that you see all this. They said she was very, very little and very, very sick. But now both these people, this couple, Taylor and Drew, they, years earlier, you know, found themselves as singles. Then they started to date. And then they got married, but they continued to both work in the NICU. And the weird thing is, they worked different shifts.
Mm.
So Taylor would come home and, you know, sort of say, tag, you're now the NICU nurse. And then Drew would become, you know, the NICU nurse. This went on for a while. But they would share stories about little babies. They both found this little baby. Her name is Ella. And she was born super early, like I said, in deep distress. They both developed a soft spot for her. And in their downtime, would hold her a little extra more so, read to her, snuggle with her. Oh. It turns out that the young mother, whenever the baby, especially early on, was sick, would come in more. But then as the baby grew and stabilized, she pulled back. And later on, she said to the couple, this now NICU nurse married couple, you know what? You're really her parents. Why don't you take her? Now, this couple, they had trouble having a baby. They leapt at the opportunity, and that's exactly what happened.
They adopted the baby.
They adopted the baby. Mm-hmm. And now little baby Ella is 3 years old and is thriving. And there's photographs in this Washington Post story.
Oh, my gosh, that's the best story.
Excellent story, right?
Oh, my gosh. What those NICU nurses go through.
They're incredible.
Seriously. And it's just, I admire that so
much.
Me
too.
So grateful.
The journey you go on to and those little lives so fragile. I mean, just fabulous. So a really good feel-good story happens in the NICU.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for coming along. An absolutely gorgeous Monday. Way to kick off the week. Happy that you are with us. And I do hope that you are on the ride home right now, actively leaving.
That's right. And looking forward to maybe sitting on the porch,
yes.
On the stoop.
Mm-hmm.
taking a walk.
Out in the backyard.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Make the most of it. It's such a gorgeous day.
Fabulous.
Incredible.
Here's a headline, which I think if you went to church regularly, you would already know. But this is from Saturday's Wall Street Journal. Active religious practice, such as going to churches or synagogues, is linked to mental well-being, according to a growing body of research.
On the show, we've talked a lot about the benefits of spiritual practice, like prayer, belief in God, mm-hmm. you know, how that makes people more optimistic or makes them more healthy psychologically, gives them hope, gives them perseverance, all those sorts of things.
Yep.
But I don't think we've talked about actually the benefits of getting up and going.
Going to church.
Because this is not watching TV on or not watching church online, right?
No, no. They're saying the full benefit of being a believer and having that good mental health is the community that surrounds you as you attend on a weekly basis. Mm. Those who attended less or did not attend at all scored much worse mm-hmm. in their psychological responses. Yeah, so here's the deal. 200,000 people were taken this survey worldwide. Those who attended religious services had higher flourishing scores of these 200,000 than those who never attended. Scores were determined through 12 questions about happiness, close social relationships, financial stability, physical and mental health, and religious practices. A study said that in 65 countries, they found that in those 65 countries with the lowest mental well-being scores had the lowest levels of religious practice, such as attending services or reading scripture. Mm-hmm. No surprise.
No, it's not a surprise. But is this from today's Wall Street Journal?
Saturdays.
Saturdays. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Places of worship with weekly services, Sunday school, potluck dinners have been places of community. The findings say that you need community where people know you and are invested in your life.
Yes.
And you will find that primarily yes. at church.
Right. Yep.
It's no surprise, right?
I know. In talking to my daughters about this when they went off to college, I said, you deserve to be known.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to find that by sleeping in on Sunday.
No, you're not.
And you can be known by people your own age while you go to college. But going to a university church where there are grown-ups there and kids there, where there are old people and there are people that are working and there are high schoolers, that is where you just – that's a family.
Right, because for the most part, especially, you know, when your kids leave, if you're an older person – you tend to hang out with older people.
Yeah.
You don't see younger people. If you're a younger person, you're hanging out with younger people. You don't mingle and mix like we used to.
Yep.
But church provides that incubator, that opportunity to do so.
It does.
And you form relationships. They tell a story in this article about a young girl. She said she grew up in a church. Then when she went away to college, several people, of course, this is you know the story, several people in the congregation adopted her,
mm-hmm.
continued to write to her, talk to her, text her, and encourage her. She said it made her feel as though I was seen. And when I reached those hard times, which of course inevitably happened to all of us, there were people around there who helped to foster her through that.
Yesterday morning, I so deeply did not want to go to church. Hmm. I cannot express.
It happens,
okay,
right?
So I had a really busy day Saturday, hosted a bridal shower for my daughter. There was a lot of details and everything that went into that. I was so tired.
Yeah.
Sunday morning comes. When that alarm went off, I actually moaned, like verbally moaned. Like, you've got to be kidding me, right? But I went.
Yeah.
Now, I was so glad that I went.
Of course.
When I was driving home, I was so glad I went. And I thought to myself, thank goodness that I'm not held captive to what I think when I first wake up.
Yeah.
Because I would never go.
All right. Because the deal is, and I've said this, you go into church if you show up, right? You make the effort, whether you're walking or driving. You go in one way, and an hour and a half, to what have you, mm-hmm. you come out different.
Yeah.
Because first of all, of course, you are worshiping as a community, right? With the Lord of the universe, our Lord and Savior Jesus. And you look around you. And no matter where you are, if you're brutalized, if it's been a bad week, or if things are okay, mm-hmm. you connect with people, and that effort pays off so tremendously. So surveys like this, I imagine people who don't go to church read that and go, eh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you lived it, if you know it, it's the best thing you can do for yourself.
I agree. It really is. It's so healthy.
It sure
because
is.
Not only are you being known, but you're interacting with people who are going through real difficulty,
yep.
people who are going through real celebration, people who are, you know, it you just become, as they say, a family
yep.
to help each other through stuff.
And it's messy. It's
it
not
is.
Like so
it's
easy
not,
to
no,
do. Everything's
right.
like, oh, this is great.
Right.
It's a hot mess often.
Yeah.
But I do know this is true. I mean, those 200,000 people who took that survey, they were telling the truth.
Yeah.
When you're isolated and alone,
yeah.
you will continue to stay isolated and alone. And when bad times happen, it only crushes you more.
Right.
You and, need each other.
And watching church, I mean, I know there are people out there who are shut-ins who can't go to church.
Right.
And so I'm grateful that there's an option for you to interact with church.
But hopefully if you belong to that church, other people show up and see you during the week, right?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm grateful that that exists. But for most, a majority of the people who are watching church, it is not because they're shut in and unable to. It's because they choose not to.
Right.
And I would just encourage any of those people who are listening right now, just give a church a try. Just stay with it for 3 months. Stay with it for 6 months. See what happens in you and see what happens when you're there.
We were just talking about the importance of going to church, you know, you and I as an adult. And of course, Kathy, you know, telling the story of the alarm going off and you're thinking.
Seriously, I cannot express, you know, I'll say it again. Yesterday, I did not want to go to church.
It happens.
I did not.
Right.
And driving home, I was just praising God that I went.
Yeah.
I
because
was.
You go indifferent.
Yep.
Right. You come in one way, you go out the other way. Right.
Yeah.
So how do you make it easier for your kids to go to church? Ann Kennedy's back with us. Ann's been a regular guest of ours over the many years. She's the author of Nailed It, 365 Sarcastic Devotionals for Angry and Worn Out People. She also has a wonderful Substack, Demotivations with Ann. Ann, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Ann, the idea of raising kids in the faith is, especially now in the era of Twitter, oft debated and decried. There are tons of people on social media who are talking about the horrible abuse, and I put that in quotation marks, not because I'm saying it didn't happen, but because I'm just, I can't verify it, but the abuse they suffered growing up in either Christian families, Christian communities, or Christian churches. First off, how do you interact with those things?
Well, I try to skirt along the edges and not directly engage, but I am reading, I have read a bunch of books by people who have deconstructed their faith and are feel the harm, the great harm that's been done to them, mostly because of the ideas that they feel, you know, are contrary to a life well lived. Things like, you know, the inerrancy of the Bible, hell, salvation by the work of Christ, things like that they would categorize as being is harmful to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been, you know, thinking about this for a long time, too. I grew up in a Christian, I'm a missionary kid, so I know my parents were terrified I was going to apostatize at some point. A lot of my friends did. And so I do think it's worth investigating, maybe not. You know, I'm not going to question the truth claims of Christianity, but I do think it is very worthwhile wondering how what we give to children will shape them and form them either for faith or not for faith. And I think there's a lot of room to do some self-examination on that score.
Yeah. So the idea of people, you know, leaving the church because they had a problem with hell or sin. I mean, I think all of us have a problem with hell and sin, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, we all do.
Yeah. So how do you talk to your kids then to make it easier for them to be a Christian, Ann?
Well, I've come up with, I've nuanced this over the years for myself. One thing I sort of discovered by having children is that children are sinners for sure, and they do need to accept the Lord Jesus themselves personally. But a lot of them maybe won't remember that moment if you've done a good job. If you treat them like they're Christian, and they it's possible for a child in a Christian home to sort of, you know, breathe that air and not ever have a crisis of faith the way that you might remember having one, or I might, but just not have any memory of not ever loving Jesus. And that's a possible thing to happen, and that's ultimately what you want. And you do that by treating them like they're members of the family of God. And
okay, and you're and you say in the article, excuse me for interrupting, Anne, that it's it's beneficial, and I would say imperative, to treat your kids like they are members of the Christian church until they give you reason to believe they're not, as opposed to the reverse.
Right. I think the way I grew up, maybe not in my household, but in my school, was that everybody assumed we were all, each of us, completely reprobate until we made a public declaration of faith. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think most often, many young children in, and even teenagers in Christian homes, cannot recall the moment when they didn't love Jesus. Mm-hmm. It happens so gradually, so incrementally, and it happens because they are just swimming in the water of the church in a good way. That's like a nice baptismal image. they want to, you know, they're part of the community. They have jobs. They are included. They're you're not watching, waiting for them to go from a life of paganism to a life of Christianity, which is amazing when it happens to many people, but your child in your Christian home probably shouldn't be one of those people who leaves their life of sin and embraces a life of faithfulness. Their life of faithfulness should begin from their birth. And I think that could be something that is much more leaned into by evangelicals in the Western sphere.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a really fascinating topic to me, because it does come down to what we say that, you know, theology is something that some people say that theology is something that's reserved for people who, you know, work in churches or work in higher level education institutions. But this is a moment where your theology really shows. If you're a parent who believes, or even if you don't say it this way, if you're a parent who believes that your kid has to prove their Christianity to you, or has to make the right decisions, or somehow has to choose Christ, then you're going to treat them differently than if you believe that they are welcomed into the family of faith from the start. Do you agree with that?
I do. I really think what you believe about how a person comes into the kingdom of God, whether adult or child, but especially how a child comes into the kingdom of God, definitely shows when you are faced with your own child and wondering if they know the Lord, and waiting on tenterhooks to find out if they know the Lord, when it may be possible. I believe, I've just in my own observations, in my own family, my own church, very young children, like before speech and before what we might call the age of reason, are able to embrace Christ in kind of a unique and beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that they're capable of that, you're going to be anxious, and you're not going to set forward the opportunities for them to live fully in the family of God if you don't think that's even possible. So you're exactly right. Theology shows in this most delicate and, you know, terrifying moment for parents.
Right. Oh, okay. So while we're talking about parental perspectives, theology, actions, in that order, can you talk about the difference between raising a kid understanding grace and raising a kid really almost seeming law-based as opposed to introducing grace at all, or even being grace-based?
Right. I think this is another point where evangelicals have a sort of anemia, I think, and that's that we often, very often, confuse what the gospel is and what it does and who it's for. And we, I mean, progressives do this all the time, but even some more conservative people mistake the effects of the gospel for the gospel itself, or they make the commands of scripture the gospel. So you might hear people saying that the gospel is to love God and love your neighbor. That is not the gospel. The law, that's the law. And you can't do that. Like, if you think you can do that, you're right. Sorely mistaken. So you cannot, even very young children obviously cannot follow the law. And they need the gospel, the grace of God, to be able to follow the law. But nobody even knows they need to follow the law until they hear, or knows they need grace until they encounter the law. And I think this is a place where the development of children through the different ages of, some people call them planes of development, is really crucial, because children will wonderfully and beautifully encounter Jesus in the scriptures, if you go straight for Jesus, and they will resonate with the images of Jesus, like the Good Shepherd and the pearl and different, some of the most essential parables that Jesus tells about himself are just wonderfully, it's like hitting a tuning fork when you read one of those parables with a very young child. But that's the identity of Jesus, who marries the law and the gospel together in himself. And if you go straight for the law, and you don't introduce the child to Jesus as he is, you really just sort of make a, it's like, I feel like you build a wall for the child that they then have to climb over to discover who Jesus is. And if you've understood the identity of Jesus and you've met him in a personal way, your desires are immediately formed for his pleasure and for the law. And then when you fail, you just immediately already know to go to him and receive the grace of Christ. And I've been with very young children for 20 years now in our Sunday school program. And if you really hone in on the most essential part of the scripture that Jesus has about himself, you open up the child to discover that distinction really experientially on their own, without you having to explain it to them, even, although explanations do come as they age. But it's a really central thing. And the two go round in a circle. You know, the law drives you to the gospel, and the gospel makes you love the law. And that's the center of the Christian life. And you only get that with true knowledge of Jesus as he is in his person.
That's good. Ann Kennedy's with us. She is the author of Nailed It, 365 Sarcastic Devotionals for Angry and Worn Out People. And before you leave us, what about resources? I mean, you say you've been, involved in children's ministry for a long time. Are you using children's Bibles or any other things that our listeners should know about?
Well, one book that's just absolutely changed my life, and it's a little bit out of the way, so evangelicals would need to take it with a grain of salt, but it's called The Religious Potential of the Child. It's by a Roman Catholic who died in the 90s, I think. But she wrote about the faith of children at the youngest ages. And she wrote about the scripture in a way that makes me as a Protestant feel very happy. I just love the way she talks about the Bible. I think when you get to questions of communion and the Lord's table, you would probably disagree with her theology for sure. But she opened the world to me to even understand how I myself came to faith as a child. And I think many of us who grew up as Christians would be able to find ourselves in her description. And it's really been a life changer for me over the years.
Wow. I just looked it up, by Sophia Cavaletti.
The Religious Cavaletti, Potential of a Child.
Experiencing Scripture and Liturgy with Young Children.
And
yes.
Always.
And if you think that children have potential for religion, you might have your mind blown.
Fabulous.
Wow, that's terrific. Thank you for that recommendation and for all your good writing, Anne.
Thank you.
Yeah, always the pleasures are, is truly.
We should get together with Ann.
Love to.
Don't you think we should get together with
Ann? Take a little road trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
She's not that far away from us.
No,
right?
She really isn't.
A few hours away. Ann Kennedy, she's the author
of... I mean, it's a lot of hours. It's not like it's a couple hours.
Right. Okay, well, someday. Nailed it. 365 sarcastic devotionals for angry and worn out people. But truly, her daily Substack, Demotivations with Ann, it is highly worth a visit. Truly it is. Ann Kennedy.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Reading a book twice.
Oh, undoubtedly. Heck yeah.
Well, you didn't even
perfect.
Have to think about that.
No.
Okay,
right?
Now listen. There are so many books in the
I
world.
I know, of course.
There are so many books in the world. Mm-hmm. None of us have a glimmer mm-hmm. of hope of reading all the things that
would either be
beneficial for us or enjoyable for us. So do you really want to waste your time
yes.
reading a book twice?
Yes.
Okay.
Because don't you love some books so
yes.
much
yes.
that they become part of you
yes.
and you go, I need to go back into that again.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Name a book.
Oh, Wrinkle in Time, off the bat.
Of course, yeah.
I've read it easily 12, 15
really?
Times.
15 times?
Oh, yeah.
The Heart is a Lonely Hunter.
Oh.
I'm sure
who's
I've read that.
Who's that
Carson
by?
McCullough.
Oh, I don't.
Five times.
Okay.
Easily. Boom.
I don't
yeah.
know that.
Yeah, I mean...
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
I've read.
Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
I mean, Grapes of Wrath. I've got a copy by my bedside that I that I have pages, like, written down. Page 43, page 20.
Really?
Yeah, that I get to and go. And then sometimes I just open it up and go, let me read. Oh, yeah, of course. That's why I saved that. Yeah.
Oh, that's paragraphs.
Yeah.
Just the way it's said.
Everything.
The word choice, the word order, the whole thing. Right,
like an arrow into your heart.
You have to read things, some things twice.
I agree.
Now, some things you finish and you're like, I don't need that again.
What the heck was that?
Why do I need I didn't really need it the first time. Or even if you did need it the first time, you don't want it a sec. But some things.
Yep. Okay, wait. Now you had that was a great one. You know, reading a book the second time. Here's me. I'm going. This is not that. Does this make sense?
What?
A green banana. A green banana. Listen, I specifically go to Giant Eagle to get the green banana.
Me too.
You do?
Me too. A yellow banana is not worth the money because by the time you get it home, it's brown.
Who cares about a yellow banana?
No.
Give me the
Invest in the future.
Please. I like a green one.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't mind if it's like super green.
No.
Sometimes it's so hard, it's like I can't even peel it.
Okay, but are you eating it then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, see, I'm not eating it if it's super green. I'll still eat it if it's green, but not super green.
But how about that feeling
Because then it sucks all the saliva out of
does.
Your mouth.
But that feeling of like super green bananas like on your kitchen counter and you go, money in the bank.
I'm telling you, because 2 days from now, I'm going to be so happy.
I love it.
Are you sad you're taking home a yellowish thing and you're
Please.
Thinking, but, you know, by the time I get home, unload the groceries and
it's
hit the restroom,
ripe?
It's already ripe.
Here's my wife. Is that brown enough? It's like, would you like a little mush ball?
Oh, and she's going to eat it when it's
yeah,
brown like that?
Yeah, she loves it like
oh,
that.
See,
I mean, whatever.
Shame.
I mean, it's good for
I mean,
our marriage.
It's good for banana bread,
yep,
I guess.
I guess.
Oh, well, whatever.
Green bananas rule.
I've always had a thing about fake flowers.
What kind of a thing?
A negative thing. I feel like if I'm going to have flowers in my house or in my office or whatever, they're going to be real flowers or there's no point in having flowers.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because real, I mean, fake flower, you know, you can't compare one or the other. It's like the difference between throwing a bullet and shooting one.
Right.
The difference between real flowers and fake flowers, right? And then over the weekend, in our, you know, kind of delving into National Poetry Month, you found a poem about fake flowers. So you sent it to me. You texted it to me. And I thought, well, this is going to be a poem because it's entitled The Thing About Fake Flowers. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a poem, which is just going to give me more ammunition for my feelings about how much I dislike fake flowers. But poems don't often deliver what you expect.
Mm-mm. So we found a pastor who's also a poet. Joel Kurz is with us. He's a parish pastor in a Missouri college town who has had poetry, essays, and reviews in various journals over the years. But this was in a magazine that I follow, Fathom, F-A-T-H-O-M. And Cass said the aforementioned, the thing about fake flowers. And here it is. My passion against fake flowers had grown to a fever pitch of disgust. But then, one day, sitting with a woman whose husband near death, I softened. I'm going to put his ashes in a vase, she said, and put above them flowers which never die.
Joel Kurtz is on the program. Joel, welcome in.
Thank you. Good to be with you both.
Oh, that's a gorgeous poem. Oh, it like I felt like a physical punch in the gut when I read it. Beautiful. Can you talk about your writing of this piece and perhaps what made you come to the place where you wanted to put this kind of thought in writing?
Sure. Yeah, it was several years ago. I was visiting with a woman who had moved out of state here to Missouri, and she had had some past history living here in the area, and her husband was gravely ill. And so he was going to be dying here. And she'd worshiped with us, and I visited with her and got a chance to meet him. And it was just born out of that conversation. And she said those very words or something to that effect. And it really did what the poem gives tribute to. That's what I was trying to capture, because in that moment, I saw things in a different perspective, not just, you know, from mine, but from hers. And she was feeling the weight of grief and the approach of his death, and didn't want flowers to die and fade. She didn't want him to die and be gone. Then I started thinking about my whole history with flowers, and especially from the biblical narrative where we have in the Psalms and Isaiah talking about the fading flowers and their glorious beauty, and the grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of the Lord remains forever, and Song of Solomon and so forth. And flowers are often seen in that context, that they do have a glorious beauty, but then the fading is part of it too. And I think when we just want to have flowers that always look the same and never age and die, then we miss out on that ability to grieve and see that the beauty often is in the fleetingness of it. Hmm.
Joel, I mean, the poem is so brief, but it's so powerful. I mean, it reminds me of, like, you know, the generation that we grew up with of putting plastic slipcovers on your couch or, you know, fake flowers. I mean, I had a dear Aunt Louise whose living room was filled with fake flowers.
Is that right?
And every time I'd go visit her, I'd roll my eyes and like I was somehow superior, you know.
Right.
But there, I'll not look at fake flowers the same
Me
way
neither.
Again.
Me neither. Joel, did you dislike fake flowers like John and I both?
Yes. So I was very pleased to hear you say that, actually. So I did. And I guess reflecting on that, a lot of my life, I grew up in the Philippines. My parents were missionaries there. And someone who was my surrogate grandfather there was a horticulturalist and a jungle forester. And so I had instilled in me from him a love for plants and especially flowers and fruits and so forth. And I worked in a college greenhouse for a while, went to work study college and took care of orchids there. And then also reflecting back when I was a child, when we moved from the Philippines to Missouri, we lived in a rural area, small town. My dad served a country parish, and we lived on a lot of acreage. And my great aunt, who died a couple of years ago at age 104 and a half,
wow,
used to press flowers and make cards out of them. And she taught me to do that when she came to visit. So, you see the faded beauty and it reminds you of when it was growing and flourishing in the field, but it is not anymore. And so, and there's so much more in addition to that, but those are some of the things that have come to the mind and the surface for me. But then also driving by cemeteries and being in cemeteries a lot as a pastor, sometimes that's all I see is, you know, fake flowers that are there. in the ground, but then, of course, they get replaced over time when they too fade and get ragged. So there's even that passage that we witness in them as well.
As I read your poem, as I said, it was like a punch in the gut. But to me, it's not even about the flowers. It's about that longing that we have mm-hmm. for a different kingdom. Hebrews calls it the city with foundations, mm-hmm. whose architect and builder is God. Where things don't fade, and where wives don't have to watch their husbands decline and die. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, the beauty of this piece.
Well, thank you. It's something, too, I think, as we're in spring and we're in Easter season. I've had two funerals this past week mm-hmm. and this weekend with our services. Prior to each one, we still have Easter lilies that are, many of them looking very well, but then some of the flowers, of course, start to wither, and it's snapping them off, before people gather. And eventually, there will be none left on them anymore. But in the meantime, we have that witness even in the Easter season that yet, yes, Christ is risen, and we still grieve, but not as those who have no hope. And I think that's one of the things that flowers bear witness and testament to, again, the fleetingness of it, but again, our desire to bring beauty and joy into the lives of others and not to miss that human element, which Christ came to redeem and did. And even in the midst of the resurrection, we still have tears and loss and grief. And sometimes we have to stuff our strong-held feelings inside ourselves for the well-being of another who is feeling that loss and grief and the suddenness or newness of it at that time.
That's so good. Jill Kurtz is with us. Jill's a parish pastor in a Missouri college town who writes poetry and essays and various journals. We found him at Fathom Magazine, where he wrote a piece, The Thing About Fake Flowers. Joel, what about being a poet? It's not something that, I'm sure there's maybe 2% of the population would say, I read poetry, let alone write poetry. Mm-hmm. Talk about that journey.
Sure. Well, I was originally growing up wanting to be a high school English teacher. I was also drawn toward mission, relief, and development work because of my upbringing overseas. And at some point when I was in college working on an English degree and also secondary the education program, I thought, no, I'm just going to study for the ministry instead and finish my English degree. So that's when that calling developed. And I guess it was actually during a time when I left the ministry for 6 years. I took care of my father at the end of his life. My mom and I kept him at home, and she needed to keep working. And he had been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease with dementia.
I'm sorry.
He always loved to write. He was a prolific reader and writer, so I inherited a lot of that love from him. And it was during that time, as I was caring for him and wasn't able to be in ministry full time, I substitute taught for a couple of years. But then when I was at home more with him is when I started working on the writing craft more and more, primarily with essays and poetry. So I've been really thankful that I've had various journals that have published my work over the years. And what I like about especially essays and poetry in particular is the fact that things are distilled. There's a craftsmanship. You hone things, and often it begins with an image or a word or a phrase. And it's a very distilled reflection on that hopefully will stay with you and is something that you want to keep returning to as well. So that's some of how it functions for me. And I always feel that there are times and events and images that present themselves to me, and I know right away this is going to be a poem or this is going to be an essay. And sometimes it just needs to weather and grow and distill over time.
Fabulous.
Sometimes they come very quickly, like mm-hmm. this one did. So,
painful life to be a poet. Is that true?
Yes. I have found that oftentimes there's a great deal of disgust in just the act of it. So just, do I have to do this? But then it's, again, like life, you know, the wrestling with it. Yeah. That, yes, it's not always easy, and that's a part of it, but there is a beauty of the Lord which shines through it, and often that's where the cross meets us before the glory of the resurrection does. So
fabulous. Joel, if people hear you and they're interested, is there a place they can find out more about your writings?
Well, I just have been published in a smattering of places, and I don't do social media or anything like that. And so I guess there are a number of poems of mine that have been published over the years in various journals. So I say just, I guess,
go search.
Look me up, do a search engine. I do have a couple coming out in the spring issue of Mockingbird magazine. And so I'm looking forward to that. And the theme issue is home. And so they picked up two of mine for that issue.
That's Joel Kurz, the poem with which we first met his acquaintance, The Thing About Fake Flowers. You can find it at Fathom Mag. That's FathomMag. Or just look up Joel Kurz, K-U-R-Z, online. Joel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Pastor.
Thank you both.
Yesterday, Andrew McCutchen, he of the Pittsburgh Pirates, hit home run number 300 in his career. Now, I think he hit about 216 as a Pirate. Koch was let go and, you know, dealt unceremoniously to the Phillies for a good while, then for the Yankees as well. But he's back in the fold as a Pittsburgh Pirate. And he's been sitting on this little bubble since late last year at 299. But yesterday, finally, he smashed a ball and got 300.
Top of the ninth.
Yep. Great rejoicing in Pirate Nation. Truly
yes,
it is.
For sure.
So Koch has reached 1,000 runs total, 2,000 hits, 1,000 RBIs, 300 home runs, and 200 stolen bases. Only 18 players in baseball history have done that.
Wow.
So you think of the...
Is that right?
Yep. Thousands
Top
and 20. Thousands. Yeah. How
oh,
many guys
incredible.
Played ball and Koch has those responsibilities? I mean, so look, I mean, I'm old enough. I loved Willie Stargell. Of course, I loved first Roberto Clemente. Then you love Willie Stargell. And it's got to be, I mean, I love Dave Parker as well. But then Koch is right in there. I mean, seriously, not since Barry Bonds has there been a Pirate who's been so impactful.
Yeah.
And, of course, the love for, you know, Koch supersedes Barry Bonds, say what you will. It just does.
Right.
Because Koch is a Pittsburgher through and through. He never wanted to leave Pittsburgh. He's going to retire a Pirate, truly is a Pirate.
And he could have wanted to retire a Pirate, come back and played for a day.
Right.
Or for 2 hours and able
Sign
to retire
a
as a Pirate. But it's better than that.
Heck
because
yeah.
he actually came back and played.
Exactly. He's not having early on. This is early on in the season. It's a slow start for
right.
Koch. But Koch historically has been a slow starter.
Right.
I'm not saying he's going to be, you know.
And this has been hanging over his head. That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, so it's out of the way right
yeah, so
now.
Yes, I wonder if maybe he'll play with more freedom and maybe, you know, his batting average will go up.
I wonder. Anyway, just good to have him on the team as that guy talking to all the young guys as
yep.
well with all that history because he's Koch. We love him.
And go on social media and see the guy and his little, what,
eight-year-old kid
who caught the ball at, you know, Citizens Bank Field. It was so great.
They're Pirate fans.
It was so great seeing Koch come out, hug the kid instantly and say, I can't believe a Pirate fan caught the ball in the middle of this huge stadium.
And they didn't want anything.
Yeah,
I mean, they just wanted,
right.
you know, I was, you know, thinking about other guys who would go, I want money or I want season tickets or whatever like that. These guys, they just wanted to meet their hero.
Right.
That's so cool.
I also want to mention what happened at the Masters yesterday. And I'm not talking about who won because I think that was a foregone conclusion.
Well, that was a great round.
But Neil Shipley from here in Pittsburgh, Carter Pitcairn also from here in Pittsburgh. Neil Shipley finished as the top amateur. And if you watch any golf, especially if you watch the Masters and see that really awkward but absolutely classic conversation that is televised in Butler Cabin at the end of the last round of the Masters, you see the person who won and you see the top amateur,
yeah,
along with the person who's representing Augusta and Jim Nantz. And so to see Neil Shipley there was so terrific. But then reading today's Wall Street Journal and hearing the story, if you didn't see the broadcast yesterday about Neil Shipley and Carter Pitcairn playing literally thousands of rounds together
all
over
kinds
the years.
Of weather,
growing up, yep. You know, finally
here in Pittsburgh,
right? Finally, Neil gets to James Madison University, and then he's the runner-up of the 23 U.S. Amateur Tournament. Anyway, he comes to Augusta, and then over Thanksgiving, his friend Carter says, or Neil, I guess, was the first one who broached the idea of Carter caddying for him at the Masters.
He's like, what? Really?
What? I mean, he's one of my closest friends. He thought he's going to be a calming influence on the bag.
You
I knew
need somebody who knows you.
I knew it'd be special, blah, 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 blah. He knows my game really well. And it was just, it's such a terrific story. Read Jason Gay's piece, who's one of the preeminent sports writers in America.
Because at the very end on Sunday, who is their partner out there on the course?
Tiger Woods.
Yes.
So Tiger's there. And of course, Tiger had a terrible weekend. Absolutely terrible
Tiger's
weekend.
Tiger's game is over.
Right. Neil Shipley ended up beating him by, I think, 4 strokes.
He did.
But just, he said Tiger was approachable, chatty. They talked about amateur golf.
They laughed.
And both of them just kept looking at each other, these guys from Pittsburgh, and saying, I can't believe this is happening to us.
You believe
how could we both be here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so he got a trophy, right?
I mean, yep. Oh, the top amateur. That's
it's a gigantic
that
thing.
That is a big thing at the Masters.
Right. So when do you go pro after you hold that? I mean, what is that? What's that road ahead even look like?
I don't
like?
Know. I right? really don't know.
He'll be invited into the pro ranks after being the top amateur. But I wonder what all those machinations are like. Anyway, congratulations to Kutch and to...
Yeah, Carter Pitcairn and Neil Shipley.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy, a production of Salem Media Group.
Do you have a spring birthday coming up? Let's make it epic with Big Air Trampoline Park inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall. Get 5 extra jumpers for free with the spring birthday special when you book a 60, 90, or 120-minute birthday party online. And don't forget, all Big Air parties include all attractions, a personal party host, and more. Make it the best birthday party ever, and don't blow your budget. Book your party now at BigAirUSA.com/Columbus. Big Air Trampoline Park inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall.